Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the case of the Army of Man-Bats. We're pleased to be joined by Susan Tsang. Susan has a PhD in biology from the City University of New York and is currently a Science and Technology Policy Fellow with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, hosted by the US Fish and Wildlife Service. So hi Susan, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks for having me.
Great, so lots to unpack even before we even ask you about your research. So tell us a little bit about the US Fish and Wildlife Service and what your policy fellow role there entails.
So the policy fellowship with AAAS is a way for them to get scientists with PhDs or engineers into the government and helping inform our policy-making decisions. And fellows are hosted by different government agencies, and in some cases, some fellows are in Congress and are working with our senators and House reps. And we try to help them make better decisions using actual data and using our expertise and our backgrounds to help with better choice making in government, which obviously we all hope would happen given the current administration. And so I ended up at Fish and Wildlife because I have a very strong background in Southeast Asian biogeography and biodiversity. And a lot of that allowed me to actually work in places that are very remote, and I ended up doing a lot of conservation work. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife is a large part of that community. They fund a lot of the projects that are out in Southeast Asia, but especially for the program that I'm working on, which is counter wildlife trafficking in Southeast Asia. We are a large partner for many of the NGOs out there.
Let's talk a little bit about your work now, what it actually kind of involves. And what did you study for your PhD, and how did that journey happen from the academia PhD into where you are?
So when I was a PhD student, I worked on the evolution of flying foxes, which are these large fruit bats that occur primarily in the Old World. And I focused on flying foxes in Southeast Asia. So Indonesia and the Philippines was where most of my field work was happening. And I have never really wanted to be a professor. I kind of hate school. I just kind of put up with it for 20 some odd years to get my PhD. And then I really, really enjoy research. Like, all the aspects of research that people don't find appealing necessarily, I am pretty okay with them. Like, I actually think it's fun to write grants because you basically get to spend imaginary money and think of a cool science question. So I've just kind of gone through this whole academia thing, and I wanted to work at a museum, and I still want to work at a museum as a curator. But at the same time, I recognize that a lot of what we are trying to do as scientists is not able to happen because of the choices that are being made by government institutions, or because we are limited in terms of the attention that's being paid to the animals that we do care about. Like, NGOs don't always pay attention to bats, for instance. And because of that, I thought to myself, you know what, I'm gonna take a little detour, and I'm gonna actually go do this whole different thing where I'm gonna learn about science policy in the US government and not really worry about going into a professorship later on, because I know for a fact that the AAAS fellowship, a lot of folks end up with a lot of opportunities afterward that they didn't even know was possible. And it still requires that you use your scientific mind to make choices and to help create, you know, some product that would be helpful to somebody in some way. And that to me is very rewarding, but at the same time, I use it as an opportunity to help pay the bill. So I think that there's an element of it to me that's just also like, it's a financial pull that's moving me away from being purely academic. And I do think that that is something that people should think more clearly about when they go into their PhD, because they always are told that the end of the tunnel for them is just to be a professor, and that's not really the only option.
Were flying foxes something that you always liked, and that's why you went into it for your PhD? Or is it something you kind of fell into and fell in love when you started doing the work?
I think it's a combination of, like, I've always really liked things that fly, and then I started working on bats as a graduate student. Like, I chose to work on bats starting in grad school, and I just really got hung up on flying foxes because I was reading all of these different papers on, you know, these phylogenetic questions and evolutionary questions, and flying foxes just really stand out to me as this really diverse group with very little work on them. And so I was curious about it, and then I started really looking into it more, like, oh, they're also all over Southeast Asia, and a lot of them on these little islands, and they are not very well represented in modern collections because it's so remote. And it was just something that, for me as a person who wanted to do fieldwork and at the heart of it is a naturalist, it just really fit very well with everything I wanted from my PhD. To the point where I spent a lot of time writing grants and being out in the field because I wanted to be out there to actually experience the research with the animal. I think I spent a total of 2 years of the six of my PhD being in the field. When I was an undergrad, I was very fortunate to also have been a recipient of two NSF REU fellowships. So one of them was at the American Museum of Natural History, which is where I actually did a lot of my lab work for my PhD later on, and also at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, which is now the Academy of Natural Sciences at Drexel University.
Was there anything particularly surprising that you learned about flying foxes or their ecology when you started looking into it that maybe you didn't expect before you started?
I really didn't expect there to be so little work on them, to be honest, because they are so obvious, yet the best studied species are the ones that occur in Australia. So Australia has like three or four species that are camping in their botanical gardens in like Sydney. And so they're really easy to study, for instance. But there are 50 some odd other species of flying foxes, and maybe like two others are pretty well known. You know, and it's because there's very few people going out there into these really remote islands to study them, even though, you know, I come from a bird background where these isolated endemics are animals that people really want to study all the time because they want to conserve them. They want to make sure that they don't go extinct on these tiny islands, but bats don't get the same kind of attention.
I mean, we're obviously big fans of bats here at School of Batman, but why do you think there's that kind of misrepresentative study level? Is it just a PR problem that they're not as ostensibly enticing as pretty birds and things, or what do you think is going on there?
There is a PR problem in that there are fewer people that want to study them, you know, like just regular people hearing about bats, they're really afraid of them. But I think that actually affects our ability to get private funds also. So if you look at a lot of birds and places that study birds, they have these private endowed grants or fellowships for studying birds in XYZ place. And that's because ornithology is very popular amongst wealthy folks. And wealthy folks have enough money to endow scholarships and grants to fund more of that kind of work. So if you look at bats, they're not appreciated in the same way. They're mammals, but they're not charismatic mammals like pandas and tigers and rhinos and elephants. And so they don't get as much attention. But at the same time, you still have bats reproducing at a rate of only one pup per year, and they don't actually reproduce as quickly as other animals their size, as they use most of their energy for flight. And so you end up having this disproportionate misunderstanding from people about how bats are doing, because they just think, oh, it's like mice with wings, and so they must be fine because we always see them in large colonies. But there are actually a lot of species of bats that are solitary, or they live in small groups, and you don't actually have that many of them. You know, they are rare in the landscape, and only some species might be doing well in disturbed landscapes or in places that we can actually see them. And that happens a lot because they are nocturnal, and so people are really not very familiar with them, and they often think that, oh, bats are fine just because I heard one bat, then they must be fine, which is a very odd thing. But I've noticed this in urban environments because I grew up in, you know, major cities, that people are just like, well, I saw one bat, so it must mean that they're all okay. But when I tell them, you know, there's over 1,300 species of bats, they're just so shocked because they didn't think that the world even has that many kinds of bats. People are afraid of them. And I think that's changing in the past few years, at least. Like, people seem to be more interested in bats than they used to be, which is great, because that means that everybody I know who's been doing conservation work and outreach is doing a great job. But I think that attention has been elevated, especially in the US in the past 10 years, because of white nose syndrome, which is a fungus that's been killing all the bats in the United States. And it's been a wildlife disease that's been going on for so long because we did not understand it well enough to stop it, and it's killed millions of bats.
It's probably time to dive into your story now. So we like to ask our guests to choose an actor to represent their Batman in their story. Have you chosen one?
So for the live action, I think Michael Keaton is my preferred Batman, but whenever I read the Batman comics, the voice that I hear is from the Batman animated series, Kevin Conroy.
Wonderful. Right, well, thanks very much. An ominous whooshing and thudding echoes around Wayne Manor, awakening Bruce from an all-too-short dream. It's a familiar sound, but more confused and far more thunderous. Staring out of the window towards the city, the twilight sky is obscured by a transmogrified cavalcade of man-bats. Stepping into action immediately, Batman is assessing the skies from his Batmobile as he races towards the city. Each man-bat looks different, behaves different, and Batman must use his brain and his body to counteract this diverse threat. Quite the setup, Susan. So I guess let's start first with maybe some reasons why this might be happening. Why might Man-Bat have made this kind of army of Man-Bats? What can they be doing? And how can your research help Bruce tackle this situation? What does success even look like here? There's a lot of questions there, so you pick and choose which ones you want to answer.
Well, I think that the first thing Batman's going to notice is that there's probably a lot of bat species that he sees right now that he's never seen before in Gotham. Because if you look at the United States, we just don't have the same level of diversity as, like, the tropics. And so if he's seeing a cavalcade of man-bats of all sorts, there's probably bats coming from the neotropics that he's never seen before. There's probably flying foxes, and they're gigantic, and so he notices them first. And he's got to understand the ecology and the natural history of each of these species if he's going to hope to actually capture them. Because catching a bat, like a real bat, not a Batman, is kind of difficult. You need specialized tools. You need to have traps that are appropriate for the kind of bat that you want to catch. And some bats fly a lot higher than others, while other bats are just going through these little alleyways, and they're probably going through the alleyways of Gotham, and Batman's gonna have a really hard time catching them if he thinks he's gonna put a net up there, because they're gonna chew right through it. And so we should probably find out why Man-Bat is turning all these bats out into the city, because these are clearly very different from what Batman is used to dealing with.
So let's take a little step back. I know you're a fan of Man-Bat, so why don't you tell us a little bit about what you think Man-Bat's motivations might be here?
Well, Man-Bat has always been a rogue who is not necessarily trying to do a bad thing. Like, in his first introduction, even in the animated series, he only keeps doing the theft of chemicals because the Man-Bat inside him wants to stay as a Man-Bat and not return to being a man. And in other iterations of him in the comic book, he's actually trying to discover a cure for deafness by studying bats. And he basically injected himself with his little serum, and he, instead of curing deafness, turned himself into a bat. So I think that, you know, figuring out what Dr. Langstrom, the man behind Man-Bat, is actually doing would be a really important point for Batman, because he needs to figure out why is it that he's doing it, because he usually means well. And so, you know, immediately jumping to the conclusion that he's committing a crime might be, you know, jumping the gun a little bit. So we need to use Batman's investigation skills first before we use his crime-fighting skills.
How would you go about maybe identifying some of these bats? Like, you say collections are very limited, and of the identified species, how many examples do we have? What kind of variants do you see across the different species?
So in total, there are over 1,300 species of bats, and in order to actually capture the diversity of them, we can use all kinds of different methods. So we can use an acoustic monitoring method, for instance. We can take these little bat detectors, which are able to hear the high-frequency echolocation calls that the bats are making. And because different bat species have different calls, you can actually identify some of them based on those calls. And there are now programs that are made to help with dissecting the calls so that we can try to figure out what species they are. And this obviously works better with species that are better known, but I'm sure Batman's supercomputer can figure that one out. For the species that I study, like flying foxes, they don't echolocate. And so if you're going to go and try to identify them, you're going to need to catch one in order to actually look at their features, like the skull shape, if they have a tail or not, how big they are, what color they are, what kinds of distinctive facial structures that they have in some cases, to actually identify what fruit bat species it is. And with flying foxes, you're going to have a very hard time just catching them on the ground because they will often fly above the canopy. So Batman's going to probably need to take his Batmobile and fly above the city and set up something that's rather high in order to actually capture any of them and identify them.
I guess, and with such a huge range of genetic diversity, we're probably going to need a lot of serums as well to hopefully kind of capture them back. Tell us a little bit about some of the diversity in bats. You've said something which was quite amazing to me, and something I didn't know, that flying foxes don't echolocate. I thought that was a pretty intrinsic quality of bats. So that's some new information to me. But sizes and size variants and colours and any other interesting properties and things like that. Could you tell us a bit about some of that diversity?
So I think people mostly think of bats as these small insectivorous animals, but when you look at the suite of diets that they have, they're not limited to just that. So in the Neotropics, for instance, there's a superfamily of bats. They're basically in every single feeding guild that you can possibly have. So this includes the vampire bats that drink blood. They actually lick blood. They don't really drink blood. But they cut a very small incision and then they lick it. And there's only like 3 species of them. But then there's tons of species that eat all kinds of insects, and then there's tons of species that also do things like eat fruit or nectar or, you know, other plant products. And at the same time, you still have bats that are carnivorous, so they will go out and they will hunt small mice, or there are bats that are fishing bats, and so they will go to the river and they will scoop up a fish from it with their more widened feet compared to other bats. And all these bats have different structures in their bodies to help them with being able to do each of these different things, right? So like fishing bats have extended feet, but then if you are a bat that is trying to drink nectar, you might have a more elongated face so that you can stick your head into the flower. And with flying foxes, you know, they don't echolocate because they're not really in that kind of space. They're usually in these very open spaces. They're not in caves. They're so big that I can't imagine one of them trying to fly into a cave because their wingspan would just be too big. You know, I think the average wingspan for a flying fox that I've captured is at least 1 meter long, and they can go up to 1.5 to 2 meters for the largest species. So they are not just these little cave-dwelling bats that you see on Batman, but you have bats that are just chilling out on top of coconut trees, flying from island to island in the South Pacific, and they are the largest flying mammal, you know, the flying foxes. But in the same family, there are bats that are much, much smaller. So they have fruit bats that are about the size of my fist only. So that's, you know, like 50 times smaller. But there's also another bat in a different family called a bumblebee bat that is about the size of the tip of your thumb. So you have very huge, you know, size differences. And Man-Bat can do all kinds of things with bats of these sizes because he might be trying to, I don't know, he might be trying to help with pest control in an agricultural environment. He might be trying to help these islands that have had environmental disasters because these bats are also the only seed dispersers in some of these places. And, you know, he often is trying to help people, and a lot of these animals are very helpful to people. And so if he really wants to do something that is beneficial to a society. He might just be very misguided and just started turning people into bats to help them along.
Sure. So tell us about some of the ways bats help people.
So in the U.S., for instance, we have a lot of insect-eating bats that eat crop pests in the South, and they're actually worth their it's called an ecosystem service. You know, they do things like pest control, or they do things like pollination or seed dispersal. And there are all these different functions that happen in the environment where the animal is a key part of being able to deliver that service to the environment. So by eating pests, they are not able to, you know, just defoliate the entire area. You know, there's the plants can still live and grow. By being seed dispersers, they are bringing seeds across oceans. In a lot of cases in the South Pacific, that's figs or other plants that are necessary to help break down soils and rock in places that are not very hospitable to other plants in the tropics. And so those are the first plants that need to be established on an island before you can get the forest to come back. But at the same time, they also disperse seeds of economically important fruit trees also. And they'll end up being able to bring them to really distant and remote places that sometimes birds are not able to get to. For instance, in the South Pacific, they used to have fruit doves there. But in some of these islands, the fruit doves that used to be native to there no longer exist because people have completely eaten the population and they're just extinct now. So the bats are the only big or medium-sized to big fruit eater. And so they need the bat to be dispersing the seeds for them. In other cases where you have these flowers that are purposely built to attract bats, they are pale in color, they have a very strong odor, and they only open at night. The bats can come in and stick their faces into the flower, and you get pollen all over your face, and then you go to another flower, and then you help pollinate it. And they are very effective, especially flying foxes. They're really big, you know, they have giant floofy faces with fur, so things attach to it very easily. And they don't really mind that they have pollen on their face when they're flying, and so they just zip around all night helping the plants. And a lot of our foods come from plants that actually might be dependent on animal pollination. So if you like tequila, for instance, agave is pollinated by a bat, and that bat helps maintain genetic diversity for the agave. Right now in Mexico, there has been some conservation work which has focused on this, and it's because they want to make sure that agave remains genetically diverse so that if they have one strain of a plant disease, it doesn't just kill the entire crop of agave that's out there. And so they're trying to make these areas into like bat-friendly agave plantations, so they keep at least one of the agave plants unchopped and let the bats come in and help pollinate it. And that's how we can make sure that we still have tequila in the future, for instance, because the agave will still live. And there are many, many different species of agave that bats actually are helping to pollinate. And people don't seem to realize that a lot of what they do and a lot of what they rely on is actually very much a function of what animals do in nature. So they don't always think of it as, oh, we have to protect this species to protect something that we do until it's too late. So like a lot of people in the past 10 years might have noticed that there's more insects, and that's not just the function of climate change making there be more insects, because now, you know, summers are longer and it's part of it, but also their natural predators, which are bats, might not exist also. And so moths also are eaten a lot by bats. Mosquitoes, some species of mosquitoes are eaten by bats. And those are not getting, you know, killed off by bats as much, and you're going to find a lot more of them in your face in the summer because of that.
So thanks to Susan for joining us and helping Batman save the day once more.
And thanks for having me. I always love helping Batman out.
You can find out more about Susan and her work by following her on Twitter at @Batgirl_Susan, and that link will also be in the description. If you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info@figshare.com, and you can find us on Twitter @School of Batman.